I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Thomas Jones, and I'm joined today by Rosemary Hill, a contributing editor at the paper, whose books include A Biography of Pugin, A History of Stonehenge, and most recently Time's Witness, History in the Age of Romanticism. In the last issue of the LRB, she reviewed Architecture in Britain and Ireland, 1530 to 1830 by Stephen Brindle, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Hello, Rosemary, and thank you very much for joining me again.
Hello.
So to begin at the beginning, as it were, why is 1530 a starting date for a history of architecture in Britain and Ireland?
Well, it's the moment just, as it were, on the brink of the Reformation, on the edge of a point at which Britain's landscape is going to change hugely. There's going to be the biggest redistribution of land since the Norman Conquest. But it's at the same time, you've got this rather sort of prelapsarian world of medieval towns, apart from London, which was already kind of very higgledy-piggledy. Most medieval towns had retained their ground plan. So we've got a population which is recovering from the Black Death, but it's still relatively small. And there's also been this thing that historians rather sweetly call the Great Rebuilding going on, which meant that houses were being reconstructed using more brick, more tile. So people's houses were basically just getting comfier. They were less drafty. They were more waterproof. You had a lot of medieval towns were on a grid plan, but not all of them were. And you had a sort of triangle in the middle with a market cross and a marketplace and probably a big house somewhere on the road nearby. And this England, of course, it was still England. Britain itself was still a sort of semi-mythical construction. There were the legend of the Trojan Brute, who was a son of Aeneas, from whom the name Britain had come. But it was all a bit mythological. England and Scotland were separate countries. And over this landscape, we, of course, know that this huge tumult is about to break. So that just as English architecture is becoming its own form of Gothic, this late perpendicular, really rather elegant. Gothic across Europe developed all these different local forms. So late Gothic is different in France from how it is in Spain, from how it is in England. But we had these rather elegant towers, this fine-boned late Gothic, and everything is absolutely, in hindsight at least, tranquil and prosperous until, of course, Henry VIII has this great row with Rome, with the Pope. And this leads not only to the rupture, the religious rupture, but, as I say, the dissolution of the monasteries, the redistribution of land as a consequence, and really the beginning of, I mean, I've always felt that most British people, whatever they say, when they think of history, if they do, Tudors and Stuarts is what it's really about. It's about Henry VIII and his wives, Mary Queen of Scots got her head chopped off, roundheads and cavaliers. And all of that is just about to break over this relatively peaceful and prosperous landscape that you get in 1530. And so I think there's always a great nostalgia somehow. It's not a coincidence that everything from Wolf Hall to the musical Six, one of the most improbable ideas ever for a musical, Six Wives of Henry VIII. Huge success, because everyone kind of knows what it's about. Well, they think they do.
And also, I mean, this isn't the first book to be written with this sort of title, is there? That it's partly a response or a riposte to John Summerson's very influential book, Architecture in Britain, No Ireland, 1530 to 1830, which appeared in the 1950s.
Yes. I mean, what Stephen Brindle has done very brilliantly and very intrepidly, really, is to rewrite the history, but also to sort of rewrite the discipline, if you like. I mean, the curious thing about architectural history, which I'm not an architectural historian, I'm a historian who's written about architecture, which is quite an unusual thing, because normally, for some reason, architectural history gets hived off into a discipline of its own. And some of this, I'm reluctant to say John Summerson's fault, because John Summerson was a great architectural historian. He was also a very good writer, an incredibly good read, which is one reason why his book, Architecture in England and Scotland, 1530 to 1830, became such a standard text. But it was also part of what happened in post-war architectural history, which received this huge boost, particularly from Nicholas Pevsner, who came in the 1930s as a refugee, who not only was responsible for founding the whole series of the buildings of England, which people still, though they've been much rewritten, refer to as Pevsner's, but he also edited the Pelican History of Art, and he asked Summerson to write this volume, which came out, I think, in 1949. And then you had Howard Colvin at Oxford working on his Biographical Dictionary of Architects. And these three all got knighthoods for their scholarship, and well-deserved. They set up not only a very brilliant basis and a framework for looking at British architecture, since, I mean, obviously the Pevsner volumes go way back before 1530, but also for what architectural history would be as a discipline. And this always surprised me when I came to it, because it's like the neutron bomb has gone off. There are all these buildings, and it's taught as a history of buildings, a history of style, a history of individual architects, but nothing about the patrons or the function or anything else, which is very odd because of all the arts, and people are very insistent that architecture is an art, which is something that Brindle, I think, very rightly questions. He doesn't deny it, but he says, you know, can it really be an art if so many people are involved, if so many other factors come into play apart from the creative ideas of one originator? But of all the arts, everybody has, you have to deal with architecture. You don't have to be interested in it, but you do have to deal with it because you have to go to work, you have to go to school. Nobody has to live in Paradise Lost. It doesn't matter if you don't like it. But if you fall into the hands of a visionary star architect and you have to live in his dream, like Alice, it can be very difficult. So this sort of conflict between the idea of the architect as sole creator and visionary and the, as it were, person on the ground who has to cope with it is something that is rather ignored by conventional architectural history. And what Brindle has done is to say, no, I mean, these buildings in Astorian with English heritage, and he says, you know, these are repositories of stored memory, of shared culture. And he's also still slightly fighting Pevsner, who was committed, not so much later in his career, but at the beginning of his career, he was very committed to this teleological idea of modernism, that modernism was not a style, modernism was a truth, and we were all moving towards it. So what, when Pevsner and his ilk write about buildings, it's they sort of criticise them a bit like children and say, you know, this one's very advanced and that one's really rather backward. And Brindle just said, well, that's no way to look at a building. There are many ways to look at a building, but whether it's advanced or not, or whether you know who it's by or not, and those things are interesting to know, but they're not the whole basis for an assessment. So Brindle, that thereby, of course, means that he's basically just got to do everything, and he more or less does, but this results in a very large book, but beautifully presented and beautifully illustrated, but big.
So it's not really a case of adding an extra story in, or an extension and shoring up the foundations of Summerson. It's sort of knocking it down and rebuilding from the ground up.
Well, he hasn't knocked down Summerson. I mean, I'd be very reluctant to suggest that this is in any way, as he says himself, you know, there have been lots of critiques of Summerson. Architectural history has changed a lot in the last half century. But it hasn't really broadened out a lot. And he's, I think, yeah, it's more of a kind of an extension rather than a demolition job.
Yeah. Or he's brought the people in.
He's brought the people in. And of course, the people are always there. And when you see what happens, I mean, sometimes what happens is a result of an architect having an idea. But often, and certainly really before Inigo Jones came back with a Renaissance idea of the architect, in the Middle Ages and, well, I mean, in 1530, there was no book published in England on architecture as a subject. People didn't really think about it at all like that. They had very skilled masons, you had very skilled carpenters. And if you wanted to put up a building, you got, whether it was a cathedral or your house, you got the very best people you could afford, as very much as now. But of course, not much was written down. People didn't really think in terms of style, though you had, I mean, there was always, you know, what's the latest thing? Well, you know, very whizzy half timbering or chimneys. Once chimneys came in, they were a big... big status symbol. The more chimneys your house had, the more hearths your house had, the swankier you were, until, of course, the government worked this out and introduced the hearth tax, after which chimneys became rather more modest in appearance. But no, people were choosing what had bay windows. Once, I mean, it all goes very much, this is another reason why architecture is not a fine art, that over time, once timber framing develops to the point where you can have a whole building, not just a sort of single cruck like a barn. And then later on, of course, iron comes in. So as technique, and then you get, yeah, you can have bigger sheets of glass. And the point of having a very, it's just like people now with kitchen extensions and conservatories. The more glass you can afford, that's a very, it's a kind of, it's a bit of conspicuous consumption to have a long gallery. It means that you can catch as much daylight as you can get in Britain, and you can exercise indoors, but mainly, well, largely, you're saying to your friends, neighbours and relations, look what we've got.
And sometimes, I mean, you write about Little Morton Hall in Cheshire in the piece, and I presume it's in Brindle's book as well. That,
yes.
And they put the long gallery on top of it, and it sort of squashed the house underneath. You can see the...
Yes. Yes, you can see the whole thing kind of bending a little bit, and it's got the sort of dazzle pattern, half timbering on it. And that's two generations of improvement. But you see it now with people digging out basements in Notting Hill Gate and putting up extra stories in East Dulwich. You know, these houses being made to practically burst with new features. And some of it is done for practical reasons. People always come up with a practical reason for what they want to do anyway. But no, Little Morton Hall is lovely, actually. It is, as he says, a very charming case study in these sort of successive inventions and status symbols.
But there's no architect associated with it.
There's not an architect as such. I mean, to do a building... Brindle very charmingly uses one of Shakespeare's many coinages, fantastical, to describe the prodigy houses that come in the early Jacobean period, where you've got people building houses which are not particularly sensible or practical. They're just wonderful, fantastical houses, like Hardwick Hall, built by Bess of Hardwick. And her builder, Thomas Smithson, was obviously an extremely sophisticated designer. And because it's a very complicated plan, and there's no suggestion that the Countess herself did that, she would, of course, have respected his abilities and hired him on the basis of those abilities. And we have a lot of his drawings left, so we can see how he worked. But no, he would have... I mean, the whole business of people becoming architects has huge intellectual and social implications. And a mason, as he would have been described, well, he described himself, a mason would have been on a level with any very skilled craftsman or perhaps with farmers, but not an intellectual, not a courtier, not an aristocrat. And it really, when belatedly the Renaissance, which Henry VIII had just cut us off from Europe very brutally, And so nobody knew really what was going on for about 70 years. But when the Renaissance finally did arrive in Britain, it brought with it this idea of the architect as a very, very elevated figure.
And Inigo Jones, who appointed surveyor of the King's Works in 1615, was the first of them, of those professional architects.
Yes. I mean, Inigo Jones brought back the idea, the concept of the architect, which was known. I mean, there were people, famously John Dee, Elizabeth I's mathematician, Magus, kind of very attractively, slightly dark figure, John Dee. He knew about this Neoplatonic idea of the architect, who is somebody who is, as it were, channeling pure form and creating it in three dimensions. And so, say, Inigo Jones brought this idea back to Britain. And although he was still known as a surveyor, he was very dedicated to establishing the idea of the architect. And he did this in various ways. He wrote a study of Stonehenge. He was the first person ever, actually, to write a whole book of about Stonehenge. And he did that. He said it was Roman, which strikes one as a bit bonkers, especially for someone who'd been to Rome. But the reason he was doing this was to try and establish a sort of an ur-architecture, a foundation myth, which would justify all this incredible pretension about what the architect was going to be. And so with that, and then when he built the Church of St. Paul at Covent Garden, he announced that it was in the Tuscan order, and that the Tuscan order, again, is this foundation order, which is a kind of Neoplatonic truth from which the orders come and the idea of proportion. And this was hugely important, that unlike medieval architecture, which everybody decided was just a bit higgledy-piggledy, like Moreton Hall, and things randomly all over the place. That was not true, but there isn't a system in medieval architecture, in Gothic architecture, of proportion in this way. So there was, it was much, this was the argument that these were objectively existing proportions according to which the architect worked to produce true form.
Well, one of the nice things that you say in the piece about that church in Covent Garden is that its simplicity also suited the patron, who, he wouldn't get planning permission unless you put a church in, and he wanted it to be like, you know, it's a nice cheap way to build a church. That,
yes, absolutely. I mean, in that way, of course, not the sort of thing that it was described as being barn-like, and Jones said, you know, the finest barn in Europe. But it suited them both. But there is always, yes, this argument between the architect's vision, the patron's requirements, and the budget. And it's once you have invented the idea of the architect, you're no longer Bess of Hardwick employing a mason. Then, of course, you begin to get the tremendous tussles between architects, patrons, and the budget, which you know, up until today, we're still very familiar with.
And one of those early struggles, famously, at Blenheim Palace between the Duchess of Marlborough and John Vanbrugh.
Yes. Well, the grateful name Marlborough, of course, had done very well for the British army. And it was Queen Anne who was at that stage best friends with the Duchess of Marlborough. They fell out later, and anyone who's seen The Favourite will have seen, well, a version of that relationship. Anyway, so the grateful nation and the Queen were going to pay for this building, and Vanbrugh never trained as an architect, but then on the other hand, at that date, training as an architect didn't really exist. Anyway, he was politically sympathetic and started work on what became Blenheim Palace. But of course, he had ideas of his own. And the Duchess, who is always written off in architectural histories as this kind of horrible harridan, wanted a house she could live in, and that they could afford. I mean, it ended up, Vanbrugh said that the Duchess should be hanged. The Duchess said that if he tried to come into the house, she'd break every bone in his body. And he was reduced to looking at it over the wall of the rectory next door. But the whole question about who is to be master and who is to pay, I mean, some of the Duchess's objections So, for example, she had all these staterooms and she was saying, well, what are we supposed to do? We have to live, we show the staterooms to visitors, then we have to live in the basement and wear ourselves out going up, because the staterooms were so high, there were hundreds of steps up to the bedrooms. She didn't want that. And meanwhile, Vanbrugh had become entranced with the ruins of Woodstock Manor in the grounds, which he was refurbishing with her budget, which she didn't want. She had specifically said she didn't want. And he was also living in it. So she was absolutely livid. And of course, as not infrequently happens with couples, the Duke was much more susceptible to all these ideas. And so she was having to kind of... she was a very difficult woman. There's no question about it. But I'm much more sympathetic to her than the average architectural historian, because really, enough is enough. And of course, they ended up in court, as many architectural projects do still today.
I mean, you write about the idea of an architect in the Vitruvian mould, and that, you know, Vitruvius in the first century BC, who, you know, we don't know much about him apart from that he wrote De Architectura. But presumably, and his patron was the Emperor Augustus. So presumably, well, I don't know. It's quite nice to imagine them having these sorts of squabbles as well, although it would have to be.
Yes, I don't know. We don't know whether they did or not. And architects, when they write, always sound much more optimistic and definite. And indeed, nowadays, when they present plans, I mean, that again is something that came in later, the idea of presenting a perspective, which you didn't have to do until really the beginning of the 19th century, where you're selling the idea of what you want to do as an architect to your potential patron. And Goodhart Rendell, who was a very good architect and critic in the 20th century, referred to the building as that tedious but necessary intermediary stage between the architect's perspective and the final finished photograph. there's nothing new about this, and I dare say even the Emperor Augustus occasionally had to kind of draw the line.
And you describe the Earl of Burlington, 3rd Earl of Burlington, as the absolute dictator of architectural taste in Britain in the middle of the first half of the 18th century, 1720s. So who was he?
He was the Earl of Burlington. But he was also, I mean, he was, in that sense, I suppose one could say he was an amateur architect. But then all architects sort of were. I mean, the idea of an architectural profession emerged quite slowly. The English have always preferred, I mean, the cult of Christopher Wren depends quite a lot on the fact that he was a gentleman amateur. You know, that's always considered really rather grander and more attractive. But no, Burlington was socially very influential. He was also very talented as a designer. And Chiswick House is this kind of, which he built, which is still there. It's a sort of model. I mean, it's a full-size thing, but it is a model. It is to show you, if you don't know what true neoclassical architecture is, it shows you. It is an exemplar. But then, of course, when you try and blend that with function, as he did in the assembly rooms at York, well, he didn't actually try at all. He was asked to design, had big estates in Yorkshire, and the people of York asked him to design the assembly rooms. And said, you know, absolutely, whatever your lordship would like. And then, but they said, you know, they did need a kitchen and they needed a hall and blah, blah, blah. And because he didn't pay any attention to that any more than a star architect would now. I mean, then you just brush aside all that kind of thing. And designed this sort of Egyptian style, very severely on classical principles. And this is the sort of one of the anomalies of classical architecture, that it does make these great claims to rationality, which in terms of proportion it has. But of course, as Stephen Brindle points this out, I mean, no neoclassical building in Britain, or very few. I mean, it's all just the classicism is applied to the outside. I mean, the proportions are designed for Greek temples in Greece. And if you're not building a temple and you're building in Britain where it rains a lot and it's cold, you're never going to build those buildings. So it is really just as much a style and a post hoc rationalisation as anything else. Anyway, the assembly rooms were hopeless because they were perfectly proportioned, but nobody could pass each other in the side. I mean, you go and see them now, and you can see they have had to be, as Brindle says, laconically, considerably modified. And of course, the Duchess of Marlborough was thrilled. And she's hopping up and down saying, yes, well, of all the nonsense I've ever seen of this kind, this is the worst. And that, she said, is saying a great deal. So it is a question of who is to be master, as Humpty Dumpty says. And it is this problem that if you are practising as an architect, seeing and understanding yourself as an artist, you're working on your vision, and really everyone and everything else is kind of in the way.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I mean, one of the details that you put in the piece about that, which I really, really liked, is that the hoop petticoats wouldn't fit, that fashion and fashioning clothing.
Yes, no, all these poor women. You know, you've got dressed up for a dance at the assembly rooms, and these hoop petticoats were absolutely, I mean, everyone wore them. And you had to, sort of go sideways between these columns, which rather spoiled your entrance. And so the side passages were only 3 feet wide, so, you know, two people couldn't pass. I mean, people were smaller generally in those days, but not that small. So, no, the idea of all these poor women wedged between the perfectly proportioned columns, I think it does sum it up. But part of Brindle's point is that, yes, that was happening, that did happen. But at the same time, there was a great deal of very ordinary, so in the best sense, ordinary, successful, functional building going on, where people were living and working. And all the time you got new building types. And it was really, in the 18th century, the great building type of the Georgians, of course, is the country house. And that was the moment when recovering, I sort of feel Stephen Brindle in his introduction is trying very, very hard not to compare the Reformation with Brexit. But I think he kind of thinks that on that model, after Brexit, everything will work very, very well, but not for about 75 years. Certainly the picture that he paints is of Georgian England inventing the country house and having once again a sort of a national style which is distinct from the continent but equally sophisticated. And of course the English, again, you have to come back to the people. Unlike the French aristocracy who wanted to be at court and they wanted to be in Paris and being stuck in the... I mean, it's the worst. If you really put your foot in it at Versailles, you would be sent back to your estates in the country. Terrible. Whereas the English really liked being in the country house became... I mean, it was a whole community. It wasn't just the world of Downton Abbey and upstairs, downstairs. There was farming, there were mills. There were whole communities there, as well as very elegant houses. And the English, not just the aristocracy, the gentry, liked being there. And so when they came to London for the season, there were great aristocratic houses in London, but like Spencer House, which still exists, and Burlington House, which doesn't in its original form. But a lot of them were quite content to live in terraced houses in squares. Inigo Jones introduced the Covent Garden, the Piazza, and this was the first time that London had not just been all higgledy-piggledy, it had a square. And squares proved increasingly popular. And at one stage, I think there were something like four dukes living in St. James's Square during the season. And they, some people bought those houses, others just rented for the season and went back to the country house, which became increasingly, as people got more interested in, more aware of landscape gardening. And the English landscape garden was really our great contribution to 18th century art and design. And it was, of course, part of the house. And Brindle makes this interesting point that the better communications become, with better roads, the more it is important to keep distinctions. So that whereas in the 1530 world, the big house would have been on the road, because that's more convenient, obviously. But once the road is better, the house retreats. And you begin to get a drive and a landscape garden, and there's an increasing sense of privacy. And in fact, that quest for privacy begins right with 1530. As soon as you can heat and light more individual rooms, you get people separating out, eating and sleeping in different rooms, and giving rooms specific functions. I mean, that is a relatively, in the terms of the whole history of architecture, that comes relatively late. So, and then, of course, in the country house, unless you've got Vanbrugh building it for you on an insane megalomaniac scale, you can make very convenient flow of rooms, which suits a modern life. And it is, as I say, that is the great building type of the Georgians, and it's where the British, because the Scots become very important at various points, particularly obviously the Adam brothers later on, that becomes a distinct British contribution to the art of Europe.
But they owed something, didn't they, to the villas that Palladio built around Venice in the 16th century. I mean, a Palladian villa is a kind of country house.
Yes, it is. But it became, particularly in conjunction with the idea of the landscape garden, where you have this, which is, yes, of course, there are continental and classical origins. And Capability Brown, who was Lancelot Brown, who became known as Capability because he would come and visit and tell you what the capabilities of your landscape were. But he was a very practical man. But in his, and he made land more productive as well as more attractive. But he was very good at creating views from what he called point blank, where he would stand in front of the house. And he could create contrasting views which mirrored the pairs of paintings by Claude Lorraine. So it was incredibly sophisticated. And yes, of course, based on Palladian ideas, but very much taking on a life of its own.
I mean, you say that his effect on landed estates was to make them more practical and economical as well as more attractive. So it wasn't...
Yes. Yes. I mean, there was also the building of the estate village, which you'd have to ask an individual villager who was moved what they felt about it. Sometimes, of course, people were enclosing more and more land. And if you had a rather sort of tatty village in the way of Capability Brown or later on Humphrey Repton, it would all be swept away. But the idea of the picturesque estate village came along, and a lot of those villages were actually just much nicer to live in as well as nicer to look at. But no, I mean, people sort of did sweep away the peasants from the drawing room view. But those, again, as Brindle says, so you get new, I mean, John Nash, who comes along as the great architect of the Regency, his designs for cottages were not only very beautiful in themselves, but they were new, they represented a sort of proving ground, an experimental area, if you like. And John Summerson later wrote brilliantly about Nash for trying out small houses, different kinds of small houses, how you could vary them, how you could make them interesting and practical. And so these new building types came out, as well as the country house, came out of the great vogue for the country house.
And there was still building going on in towns and cities at the same time. I mean, you've talked about squares and so on.
Oh, absolutely. Squares. And then at Bath, John Wood Sr. and his son, the unimaginatively named John Wood Jr., rebuilt Bath. And again, actually, it's very curious, and it's not just because I've written a book about Stonehenge, but again, Stonehenge was an extraordinary inspiration, as it had been for, I mean, Jones used it, to make points about the nature of architecture. But John Wood was obsessed with the idea of the Druids and the idea that Druid law, L-O-R-E, was embodied in Stonehenge. And from that, he conceived the idea of the circus. He was the first person to build such a thing. In Bath, which has the same number of houses as stones at Stonehenge, and if you look up, it's got Druidic symbols. And he built that. His son, he didn't live to build the crescent, but this was the idea that Stonehenge represented the sun, the crescent would represent the moon. And so you've got these two new street plants, circuses and crescents, which began at Bath. And of course, Bath was terrifically fashionable. And people built more circuses. The first in London was St George's Circus. And they varied the street pattern. And you see them in Edinburgh, of course, and in the squares in Dublin too. But at the same time, because of the classical doctrine and, of course, practicality, these terraces can be very monotonous. And once the French, got from the French the idea of the sliding sash window. So windows don't open out anymore. They go up and down. Or more often, of course, they don't. They get jammed. And readers of Tristram Shandy will be aware of the extraordinarily personal accidents that can take place with a suddenly crashing sash. But basically, you get the street front being flatter and flatter and flatter to the point of monotony. And I quoted de Faucompré, who's one of my favourite antiquaries, who was the translator of Walter Scott, Frenchman who came to England, loathed it, wrote a hilarious account of his 15 jours à Londres, which starts out arriving at Dover and having a huge row with customs, and they confiscate his chocolate and he never gets over it. But his complaint, des briques, toujours des briques, and of the monotony of the London streets, is something that some people certainly felt. On the other hand, of course, it was very hard. It is still where you see surviving Georgian streets and terraces harmonious. And actually, apart from my reservations about sash windows, it's a pretty convenient way of living. And many people, including many modernist architects, like to live in Georgian houses.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that question of circuses and crescents that curve streets being based on Stonehenge and so on? Because often if you have those sorts of streets in Italian cities, for example, it's because it's where there used to be a Roman circus and the streets still follow that old shape.
Yes. One of the things that Brindle brings out very well is how, for all the talk of originality in architecture, and there is originality, of course there is, but people, many things, this is against the idea of the sort of Pepsnerian, Hegelian idea of progress, but things get invented and forgotten and rediscovered and reinvented all the time. And certainly, I mean, the great thing about timber framing is that it's prefabricated. And prefabricated architecture that you can assemble, disassemble, move, extend is something that we invent, forget, and invent again over and over again. And as you say, the circus is a classical idea. But of course, for John Wood of Bath, it was terribly important that it was nothing to do with the Romans. It all went back to Bladud.
I mean, is that the beginnings of or part of the Gothic revival? Is that a difference? I mean, the idea that we're not looking to classical, we're looking to ancient vernacular English forms rather than continental Roman forms.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that sort of begins to happen as the 18th century goes on is that, I mean, you get the sort of great tick-tock from the Apollonian, the Dionysian, whatever. But people started to look at the past rather differently and to consider... Gothic was a term of abuse. The Middle Ages it just meant crude. It was the sort of art that you had before the Renaissance, before people discovered perspective, before they discovered proportion. It was all just kind of a mess. But then with the kind of dawning of a more romantic, we would say romantic movement, whatever, people began to look at the past differently in two ways. First of all, they began to look at the buildings and the artefacts differently and not to consider them as just crude. And then also they began to think, well, what is the past for? I mean, for the Enlightenment, for the Georgians on the whole, this is a huge generalisation, but in general, what did you want the past for? Well, you might find wonderful models in it, as you did in classical art. But if you didn't find anything useful in it, why would you bother with it? I mean, the Georgians if they were using a medieval building, they'd just kind of knock sash windows through it at convenient points. And if they weren't, they would let it fall down. They had no interest in preserving the past, the physical remains of the past, for their own sake. And that idea, that whole shift in attitude towards the past begins round the end of the 18th century and then kind of bursts out very conveniently for historians' purposes in 1789 in England with a huge row at Salisbury Cathedral, where James Wyatt, who was the kind of surveyor, he was part of the Office of Woods, and so he was kind of like a state architect. And he'd been commissioned by the Bishop of Salisbury with the support of George III to neaten up and improve Salisbury Cathedral. And he was doing this by whitewashing over all the hideous old medieval wall paintings, taking out some of the stained glass to make it lighter. I mean, this you know, the classical idea that it had to be light, bright and symmetrical, which medieval buildings are not. And so he dug up St. Osmond, who was the founder of the original cathedral, was moving all these tombs around and having, you know, everything was going swimmingly until a group of antiquaries, led by Richard Gough, who was the director of the Society of Antiquaries, objected. And why was that? Everyone was kind of thunderstruck. Why would you object? But it was the beginning of this idea that the remains of the past should be respected, that they should be preserved, that the present has a responsibility towards the past and also towards the future. And we are very grateful to the Society of Antiquaries, who they couldn't stop Wyatt at Salisbury, but they did stop him from knocking down the Galilee porch at Durham Cathedral, which is now a World Heritage Site. But it was this was a completely, and Brindle quite rightly emphasises this, nobody'd ever had to face this before, a group of people saying you can't do that because it's old.
So, I mean, Wyatt is one of the sort of great villains of your book, Time's Witness, I seem to remember. Well, maybe it's not fair to call him a villain, or maybe it is.
Yes.
Is he a villain? Total villain.
No, it's completely fair to call him a villain. Stephen Brindle is much fairer than I am, and he puts it in context. But the truth is that Wyatt was, I mean, on his day, he was a really very, very gifted architect. There's no question about that. But like many very gifted architects, his attitude to architecture by other people was to want to destroy it. And that is a quite notable trait in architects. They're not very keen on preserve. Wren was an exception. Hawksmoor was an exception. But that is unusual. But anyway, now Wyatt was so furious at having been thwarted by this bunch of antiquaries. And again, of course, class comes into it. They were rather kind of middling types, and he was not. In fact, well, he was a court architect. And when it came to doing work at the old Palace of Westminster, the old Houses of Parliament, where Wren had preserved in St. Stephen's Chapel, he'd put panelling in, but he had very carefully preserved the medieval wall paintings behind. Wyatt took the panelling off, and under the pretense of expanding the chamber, which was needed because of the Irish MPs who were now being brought into the Commons, didn't actually make any more space, but he just had all the wall paintings pickaxed. And they were perfectly preserved by Wren. Now, I find that very hard to forgive. And in fact, nobody did forgive him. And when he was killed, he was also by this stage drinking very heavily and increasingly unreliable. And he was killed soon afterwards in a carriage accident, and nobody at the Society of Antiquaries was very sorry.
And I'm not sure what date we're at that point, Wyatt died, but around 1830, conveniently or not?
Well, it was before then, but no, we're coming up to 1830.
And why is 18? I mean, is the death of George IV, but why is 1830? If we begin in it, right, it's 300 years since 1530, but why else is this an end date for this history?
I think partly because, I mean, Summerson stopped there because it was the death of George IV, and because you have to stop somewhere, and because really by then, architecture, building, it's all getting, it's kind of, the history is sort of trumpet-shaped and everything is getting bigger and bigger and more and more. And as Stephen Brindle points out, a lot of the things that we associate with the Victorians, the mills, the factories, the dockyards and the very early railways, They are actually Georgian, and of course the Victorians developed them. So the built environment is getting bigger and bigger. Cities are expanding vastly. This population from 1530 is not only a much bigger population, but the percentage which is living in urban environments is much higher. And of course, medieval towns were planned. You get planned towns like the new town in Edinburgh or like Bath. But nobody has planned for what's happening in Manchester and London and other big cities. So it's a moment when Summerson sort of stops with a mixture of relief and horror, because architecture itself, who are the patrons now? It's all getting slightly out of control. Brindle keeps it in control. But you're having to think about an enormous number of things, including, as I say, railway architecture, which is hugely important, factories, warehouses, and no longer a sense of who is dictating taste and style. Where's it all coming from? And architecture is beginning to be organised as a profession. People are beginning to be trained for it. So again, everything is shifting about. And you can either see that, as Summerson saw it, as a kind of, oh my God, this is a nightmare moment. Or as Brindle does, just say, well, it's here that you can see the seeds of what's going to become the modern built environment, the modern world.
And it's after the end of the book, but Pugin's Contrasts, which he described as the first architectural manifesto.
I think it is the first architectural manifesto in the sense that it is making claims for architecture beyond it should look like this or it should be considered like that. He is making the point, and this is by this stage, of course, the Gothic revival, this interest in the Middle Ages, has been transformed from, you know, Horace Walpole at Strawberry Hill, even William Beckford at Fonthill. These are very wealthy, privileged individuals using Gothic to make a point, a rather countercultural point. And really, 1830s is the point where it all turns around. And it ceases to be this private, as I say, slightly contrarian countercultural style, and is about to become the national style with the rebuilding of the Palace of Westminster, of a great imperial power. And what Pugin was saying in Contrasts, he was saying that, you know, Gothic architecture is Christian, and therefore it's more suitable for a Christian country than pagan architecture. Well, like most architectural theories, it's just a post hoc rationalisation of what he wanted to do anyway. But what is not, what is truly radical and is undeniable, I think, and is too often denied by architects, is that because architecture shapes society, and you can tell a lot about a society from its skyline, you know, where does it put it, where its treasure is, there also its heart will be. So if your skyline is dotted with spires, you're living in a very different world from if your skyline is dotted with factory chimneys or one might think now tower blocks of the City of London or whatever. It will just tell you what you're like. And that was a very new way of looking at architecture, of conceiving architecture. And it entirely arises from the fact that you've got people living together in these much bigger numbers than ever before. How are you going to organise people? How are they going to live together in a way that isn't just chaotic, as a lot of parts of certainly Manchester and London and the expanding cities were becoming chaotic? So Pugin looked back, as I say, this pre-Reformation landscape, which is and also seems to be so calm, so orderly, so safe, so readable, not this violent chaos of the modern world. And so that was the moment at which, as I say, the idea of reviving the Gothic went from being a sort of a taste thing or a propaganda thing to being a whole style for a nation, and creating buildings where people would feel, well, I mean, seeing arguments that go on now about modernism, creating streets, creating architecture on a human scale, making it humane, making it connected. Not having the panopticon, of course, was the utilitarian archetype of architecture, which Pugin was attacking, making it dignified, making it fair.
Which brings us back to that question that we talked about at the beginning, that recognising that buildings have people in them.
Exactly. And people will assert themselves. I was sort of much later, of course, but I was on Saturday, I was in Thamesmead, which, of course, is one of the biggest housing estates in Europe, built in the 60s on Corbusian principles, with streets in the sky. And what's everyone done? They have, outside their houses and flats, they have built trellises. They have broken the streets in the sky down into individual balconies. And many people have bought and self-assembled garden sheds at first floor level, because that's what they want. And it's extraordinary to see how, like sort of grass through cobbles in Defoe's Journal of the Pelagia, people's actual needs assert themselves against the architecture. And of course, it's much better when the architecture and the people go together.
Rosemary Hill, thank you very much. You can read Rosemary's piece in the 21st of March issue of the LRB. A new issue is out today with Brandon Taylor on Zola, Mary Wellesley on the history of women's words, Mike Jay on sleep, and the text of Hazel V. Carby's LRB winter lecture, Remembering the Future. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourne. The music is by Kieran Brunt. I'm Thomas Jones. Thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.